And so we want to thank Mindy for coming back. She had such a good time last time, right?
Yeah.
Came back. This is awesome. So Mindy is a recent graduate of Stern College for Women. She majored in Judaic Studies and Art History. And she graduated as a valedictorian of the Rebecca Ivry Department of Jewish Studies at Stern College. And she is currently pursuing a master's in Talmud in GPETS and a master's in medieval Jewish history in Revel. Excellent. She also serves on the editorial board of the Lehrhaus and as the adult and teen educator for Congregation Keter Torah in Teaneck. So thank you so much, Mindy, for coming back. We're excited to have you.
Thank you. Okay. So the title of this year, Titin Emet Yaakov, the Lechot of White Lies. So I titled the Lechot of White Lies. I think someone mentioned, the topic looked interesting. So we're going to be talking about a lot of types of lying, but I feel like white lies is like the most maybe applicable to our daily lives. So that's why I singled it out as something that hopefully we'll walk away with maybe a little bit of guidance or ideas about what to make of white lies. So I think that's something we can, you know, it's probably logical for us to say I shouldn't lie in court, we'll get to that, or I shouldn't lie and steal something from someone, you know, that seems like pretty obvious. But there are gray areas, so that's what I want to talk about today, and I think that's something that's very relatable. And I titled the Titin Emet Yaakov, which is from the Tanakh, I didn't make that up, because I think it's fun to talk about, even when in a halacha shir, it's nice to always bring it back to the Torah and try to relate it a bit, you know, kind of bridge the gap between the world of halacha and the world of Tanakh. So that's why I wanted to start with Yaakov. With the story of Yaakov. And we're going to connect it a little bit, and we're going to come back to it at the end and see what we learned and how we can then apply it back to what we talked about at the beginning. It'll just be a nice little frame for us. So we're going to start with the story of Yaakov when he infamously or famously, depending on which parshan you ask, steals giving my hand away as to how I feel about it, but he takes the bracha from his brother Esav, and he does it through a certain amount of deception. So I guess I'm trying to think of neutral words, but it's kind of hard to neutralize it. The honest fact is that he dressed up as someone else, and his father is blind, and he pretends to be someone else. The psukim make this very clear. But I want to focus on a really interesting comment of Rashi. So if we look at the bolded pasuk, Yaakov is coming over to his father. He's dressed up. He has the fur on. You know, he got the whole scene set up. And we see in pasuk Yitzhak, this is source 1, Vayomer Yaakov el aviv, Anochi Esav b'chorecha, Asiti kasher dibarti elai, Kum na sevav achlana misadiv, Avor t'rachani nafshecha. Okay. And then we see also in the intervening psukim, Yitzchak, we get like kind of his inner workings. He's confused. This doesn't seem right. Kocho Yaakov, Adai Mide Esav. And then we have in pasuk Chavdalet, Vayomer Ataze b'ni, so Yitzchak is confused, and he says, Ata Zebni Esav, is this really my son Esav? He says, Vyomar Ani, and he says, it's me. Okay, so Rashi, just to give Rashi a little bit of a framing, he is in line of commentary and tradition on this story that is coming to defend Yaakov. So I feel like I mentioned last time, there's a whole other shiur on this topic. So again, there's a whole other shiur on this topic of how do we view this action of Yaakov? Do we view it as a positive action? Do we view it as a negative action? There's so much polemics involved in this. Who Esav represents? Esav represents Edom, and Yaakov is Israel, and there's this whole, fight for who's going to be in control. And this is like a huge, huge thing. And you can probably, set up two camps, which is, even amongst the Jewish sources, which is to criticize Yaakov for what he did. Everyone is flawed. Some people make mistakes, and Yaakov made a mistake. Or to say, Yaakov didn't do anything wrong. This was totally right. This is what he had to do. The bracha needed to go to him. And the ends justified the means, basically. I don't think anyone is going to pretend that he didn't deceive his father in some way. But it's really an ends justify the means kind of conversation in defending Yaakov. And so Rashi's comment is in that line of justifying Yaakov's action. So just to contextualize it a little bit. So first we see on Pasuk Yotet, Rashi gives us a very clever, cute little way of understanding what Yaakov said to his father. Anochi Esav Bechorecha. Anochi Hamevilecha Ve'esav Hu Bechorecha. Okay, so I pause, hard stops. He says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. So Rashi puts in a period where we would think logically it doesn't belong. Anochi, I am me, the one who brought you these things. And Esav is your Bechor. Great. Okay, and then in Chav Dalet, when we had Vayomer Ani, Lo Amar Ani Esav, Ela Ani. So Rashi is again being medactic in the language. The fact that Yaakov didn't say Ani Esav means he was, you know, he's not really lying. That's kind of what Rashi is trying to say here. What's Rashi trying to accomplish? It seems like he's trying to say, kind of get Yaakov, maybe kind of backpedal the wrongdoing. That he didn't, maybe he deceived his father, but he didn't lie to him. This was not a lie. Okay, so on the face of it, it seems kind of crazy and absurd. This is a lie. But we're actually going to see some ways that this sort of lie actually gets reflected into the halacha and the conversation of things which are, you know, things which can have a double meaning or things which are true the way you perceive it, but the other person will perceive it differently. That's basically the situation. It's Ani. So Yaakov, when he's saying Ani, he's saying I am me. But he knows that when his father hears Ani, he's going to hear I am Esav. So we're going to actually see this as kind of ridiculous as it sounds. We're really going to see this in the halachic literature, and we're going to try to get some perspective on this action of Yaakov and then our own actions, obviously, online. So let's get into the halachic conversation now. So we have three places in the Tanakh, in the Torah, where we have a prohibition against a certain type of lying. So I wrote the prohibition of Midbar Sheker Tircha, because that's really the only one that's relevant to our conversation. The other two, so first we have Lo Tana Bereacha Eid Sheker, so that's only in the context of court, don't be a false witness. So that's no lying in court. Then the second one we have is Lo Tishaker Ish Ba'amito. That means that you actually, the specific context of this is swearing falsely to avoid returning someone's property. So this would be stealing. Okay? So those are both contextualized very specifically, that they refer, one, to court, and then two, to swearing in order to keep property that doesn't rightfully belong to you. So those are the two, maybe like if you're thinking about things about Sheker and the Torah, that those would probably come to your mind, but they're not really relevant here, because again, we're talking about, you know, more general prohibition against lying, not what was intuitive to us already, which is that you can't lie to steal, and you can't lie in court. Okay, so we have one pasuk left that might be our general prohibition against lying. So that pasuk is Midbar Sheker Tirchak, but we actually have a machloket about whether or not this pasuk actually is a general prohibition against lying, or it's a more specific or contextual prohibition against lying. So let's look at the context. So we have in pasuk Zion, Midbar Sheker Tirchak, that's our pasuk, distance yourself from lying. The pasuk before, Lo Tat'eh Mishpat Evyonach Ribo, so this is talking to a judge, that the judge should not, you know, go one way or the other in his judgment. And then the pasuk after, so we have this nice Oreo over here, in pasuk chet, v'shochad lo tikach, you also should not take a bribe. This is, again, referring to a judge. So we have the first pasuk talking about a judge, talking about court. The last pasuk talking about a judge, talking about court. This middle pasuk, should we then assume, is talking about just court, Midbar Sheker Tirchak, in the context of court cases for judges should stay away from lying, or is it Midbar Sheker Tirchak for everyone? And then we have what we're looking for, which is our prohibition against lying. So we see in the Mefarshim, split on this issue. So Ibn Ezra takes the opinion that it's only about court. Makes sense, actually, when you think about Ibn Ezra, because, you know, it's all about the context, it's all about, you know, the rational reading. Rationally, it does seem like we're talking about a court case. If what came before was about court and what came after was about court, it makes sense that the middle pasuk should also have the same exact, topic. So Ibn Ezra, we see in the bolded words, he says, Shelo yadin din sheker, that a judge should not judge a false judgment. That is Midbar Sheker Tirchak. So if that's the case, just let's, you know, spell it out completely, then we do not have a general prohibition against lying, which means if you just lied, you ate meatballs for dinner, and someone asked you to eat for dinner, and you say lasagna, you do not lie. And as long as you didn't eat them together, you have not committed any avera. So you're really fine. that's the implication of this position. Okay, the Sforno, though, and the Ktava Kabbalah take a different position. Oh, just, sorry, about the Ibn Ezra. This actually fits with the Gemara in Shvuot Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph. It gives a whole list of, you know, these cases, and it says, how do we know that this is prohibited? Midbar Sheker Tirchak. And all the cases are court cases. So that kind of does bolster it. I guess if you had to argue the other way, you could say, well, just because these are court cases doesn't mean that it also doesn't apply to non-court cases, but it does seem to bolster the opinion that it is about court cases because that's what it's being brought to, you know, cite as a source. Okay, but let's see the other side. So Sforno dispels it out simply, Mikol davar sheyachol lesaviv sheker. Anything that that surrounds sin. So why did he, first let's just clarify, why did he say soviv sheker? Because it didn't say do not lie, it said distance yourself from lying. That's why he's using this language of anything that's around swearing. Not just to distance yourself from lies, but anything that seems like a lie, anything that's kind of in the, you know, perimeter of lying, that is forbidden. So now we have our general prohibition. You cannot say that you had spaghetti when you had meatballs, or lasagna, whatever the example was. Okay, the Ketavah Kabbalah goes one step further. As we already pointed out, the language of Midbar Sheker Tirchak, you have to distance yourself from lying, is kind of a strange way to express an Isser. What would we think it should be? You would think it would be Lo Tadaber Sheker, like every, you know, Lo Tirzach. Most Isserim are written out, Lo Taseh is written, don't do this, not, you know, avoid doing this. It's strange. So the Ketavah Kabbalah actually goes one step further, and he says that he asks this question explicitly. We see in source 6, Shena katuv lomar ha'azarab lashon zav, lo amar lo tadaber sheker. Lufi she'en avira yoter tadira umitsiyoi kimo davar sheker. Okay, so it's clear he's talking about a general prohibition, because he's saying, why did it say it in this way, distance yourself? Because there's nothing that's more, you know, commonplace, it just gets us every day, nothing more than lying. We just lie all the time. It just happens, at least for me. Can't speak for anyone else, this is relatable. You know, you don't even realize sometimes when you're lying. It just comes out, and you don't even know sometimes why you did it. Sometimes it's, you know, it's an ego thing, you want to save face, sometimes it's harmless, as we're going to talk about harmless lying versus not harmless lying, but it really does just come out sometimes, you know, you just say something and it wasn't true. And it's hard to pin down why we did, and it's kind of, if you really thought every day, if this is a good, just an exercise, if one day you went through the day and every time you lied, you counted it, it would probably be a lot of times, and you're not a malicious lying person. It's just that's what happens, you know. So that's why you have to distance yourself, because it's so prevalent. It kind of reminds me of the language of like "ain't not be trustworthy arayos." Like, you know, no one is trustworthy. It's just everyone does it. That's the way it is. So you have to guard yourself. You have to "ain't not be trustworthy arayos" means no one is trustworthy when it comes to sexual matters. So that's why we have all these like guards around sexual matters and not committing arayos, because no one is trustworthy. So it's the same thing with sheker. You have to distance yourself because it's so common. It just gets everyone in that trap. That's the next bold. So that's why we put it in this language, in order to make a greater hachaka. And then interestingly, he actually brings the Gemara in Shavuot that I mentioned on Lamed Aleph as a proof for this point. Because all those Gemaras, even though they're about court cases, they happen to be cases that are not explicit lies. They're all things which sound like a lie, things that might lead to a lie. And then the Gemara tells you, Midbar Sheker Tirchak. So interestingly, the Kabbalah brings in those cases and he says, and here we have proof that this prohibition is a general prohibition to distance yourself from anything that seems or smells and has the whiff of a lie. Just stay far away from that, because we have all these cases where they're not really lies. Obviously, the Gemara doesn't have to bring a case that says, let's say, I lent Shira $100 and I never paid her back, and she says, give it back to me, and we're in court. The Gemara doesn't have to bring a case that says, Mindy cannot lie and say that she paid back the $100 because Midbar Sheker Tirchak. Because, first of all, we already had Lo Tana Be'reacha Yit Sheker, and we had Lo Tishak Yishba Mito, so we had other psukim about that. And also, it's intuitive that you cannot steal. Well, that lying is really stealing. But this is saying things which might, you know, lead to something like that, things which might smell like a lie, that's also prohibited. Okay, so now that's our mefarshim. Now I want to turn the page. We're going to look at a test case, and we're going to see how this general prohibition plays out. We have this Gemara, which you might have heard of because it's kind of silly, so it's like one of those Gemaras that people sometimes hear because it's a little bit silly. A machloka betil betshamay about what to say to a kala who is not beautiful. Disclaimer, every kala is beautiful, every kala is, and we're going to see that, okay, but this happens to be a case where some people think she's not beautiful. Okay, so beauty's in the eye of the beholder, as we'll see. And basically, there's really three ways that this machloka can shake out and how we can understand what Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are really arguing about. And that is going to help us understand what is the general prohibition against lying, what are we prohibited against. So we're going to see three different ways. So first, let's learn the Gemara, and then we're going to go into the different ways to understand it. Okay, so you see in Masechta Ketuba we have Tanur Banan. Ketan Meraktim Lifnei Hakala. Beit Shammai Omrim Kala Kamochihi, Beit Hillel Omrim Kala Ne'evach Asuda. Now imagine a Ketan Meraktim if someone just started like showering comments about the bride's looks instead of dancing and doing shtick. Much nicer what we do. But what they wanted to do is, you know, how do you, you know, Ketan Meraktim, like how do you, I guess, make a bride joyful? So what should you say? So make sure I may say it like it is. If she's a model, tell her she's beautiful. If she's ugly, the implication is, do not say that she is beautiful. Okay? And Beit Hillel Amrim Kalana Evachasuda. And Beit Hillel say, tell her that she's beautiful. I just want to make a clarification here. The implication is that you have to say something. Like, you can't lie. I think something that really gets people when they read this Gemara is, why didn't Beit Shammai just say, don't talk? Like, that's, you know, the socially normal and accurate thing to do is, you know, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. But there seems to be an implication here that you have to say something, because otherwise there's no, you know, conversation here. They're saying, tell it like it is, not don't say anything. So I think that's important for what's going to ensue here. Amr lehem Beit Shammai leBeit Hillel. Hareshai tachi gered asuma, amrinan leKal ana evachasuda. Okay, so Beit Shammai says to Beit Hillel. Okay, also this is not very... We don't have the same views about people with disabilities today as they did then. Okay, someone who is, you know, lame or is blind, should we really say that she is na'av chasuda? V'hatorah amra, amidbar sheker tirchak. Here's our pasuk, general prohibition against lying. Amri lahem beit hillel beit shammai, l'divreichen, mi shalakach mekach ra min hashuk, shavchu beinav, o yigananu beinav. Okay, so Beit Hillel says to Beit Shammai, according to your approach to life, that you have to actually tell like it is, if she's ugly, say that she's ugly, then if someone, you know, your friend goes in and buys a nice watch in the shuk, you should, and it's a bad purchase, she just got totally ripped off, you should tell him or you should not tell him? Have Omer, Yeshavchu Beinav Mikana. Okay, but obviously you know that you shouldn't, you know, tell him that he got ripped off. There's a sort of an implication here, an assumption here that's not said outright, which is you don't tell someone after they make a purchase that they made a bad purchase. That's sort of like an underlying assumption. So they're making that comparison so beautifully to marriage, that if someone made a purchase, you know, you don't want to tell him. Now we're kind of directing it towards the husband. You're going to tell his husband that he has an ugly wife? He just married her.
Do you do it when they get engaged?
Let's assume that this is at the wedding. Have Omer Yeshavchu Beinav Mikan Amru Chachamim Li'olam Tia Da'ato Shel Adam Merevet Im Habriot. Okay, and from this, the fact that, you know, this with this Mekach case, the fact that you should tell someone that it's good, you know, like say, great job, like, great purchase, nice watch, you really got a good deal, is from there we see the Chachamim tell us this idea that you should always have your, like, Da'adam, you know, should just be more everyday, my beard. Like, just get along. You don't, like, you know, just stir the pot. Just, like, say things to people that will make them feel bad. Nice idea. Kiyata Rav Dimi, Amar Hechi Misharu Kimi Kaltav Marava, Lo Kachov, Velo Sarat, Velo Pirchus, Va'alata Chin. Okay, this is nice. So, in Marava, in Israel, they used to sing, you know, you don't need eyeshadow, you don't need rouge, you don't need any braids, you're a graceful ibex. This is what they would sing to the Kala. So nice. It's getting mixed messages here, you know. We're saying, like, some people are ugly, but we're also saying, you don't need any makeup. Kiyasam Chura Banal Rabbi Zera, Sharulei Hachi, Lo Kachov, Velo Sarat, Velo Pirchus, Va'alata Chin. Okay, and the Rabbanan agree with him. So the conclusion seems to be that we hold like Beis Hillel. As we know, usually we hold like Beis Hillel, except in the explicit cases that were given where we hold like Beit Shammai. So here, thankfully, we hold like Beit Hillel. You should tell the Kala she's Na'ev Chasuda. But now we want to figure out, what were they really arguing about? What was the underlying machloket? So let's look at the first approach, which is in the Maharsha, and we're also going to see it in Rashi, which is, first of all, what did they agree about? They agree that in general, there is a prohibition against lying. Lying is esser, not just in court, you know, in general, any lie, spaghetti is lasagna, etc. But Beit Hillel think that it's okay to say something truthful that you know the other person will interpret in a different way. So let's see how that shakes out. Basically, Beit Hillel are saying you can say something that has a double meaning. What would that be here? So this is actually quite nice. Basically, Goda Rotzel Amar, which is in the second line of the Maharsha, Reish Lamed. Rotzel Amar, De'ein Zeh Sheker, Kivan Shebein De'Be'einav, HaMekach Tov. Okay, so what is Beit Hillel's logic? It's not really a Sheker to say that she's Ne'ev Chasuda, because to the groom, she is Ne'ev Chasuda. So even though it will be perceived differently, the groom hears and he thinks, oh, he thinks my wife is beautiful. But when Beit Hillel is saying it, they mean, no, you, the groom, think she's beautiful. So it's something that has a double meaning. You're giving someone kind of a false understanding. Okay, let's keep going. So how do we know that she thinks he's an Avachasuda? Because otherwise he wouldn't have married her, which is so nice, right?
He wouldn't have married her unless he thought she was beautiful. So you know when you say it that it's still truthful. It's not a lie, because you know for a fact that the groom thinks that his bride is beautiful, otherwise he would not have married her. Chazaka, ein adam, nesoi, isha, shalo, chashav, yuna, v'chasuda. We have a new chazaka here. Anyone who marries someone thinks they're beautiful, so you know you're not telling a lie. All you're doing is saying something that can be perceived differently. Okay, but Beit Hillel don't agree, because, what would you think is the issue here, I guess? If you had to say, why would Beit Shammai disagree? Why shouldn't you say that? Beit Shammai is someone who's a little bit hard to understand in this sugya. I'll give you that. One thing that comes up is maybe it's gnevas das. To say something that you think someone else is going to perceive one way, and you know they're going to perceive it in the way you don't mean it. And it kind of is a little bit for the groom now to think, it's clear that the groom will understand it differently than you mean it. It's not like you're saying, oh, she's an Eva Chasuda. Maybe he'll think I mean it, maybe he'll think you. He knows, that the groom is going to think you think the bride is beautiful. So there is some element of Gnevas Das. That might be what Beit Shammai is saying. Or it could be just, an absolutist approach. Beit Shammai is, the Kant of their generation. There is no lying, categorical imperative, you're not allowed to lie. And Beit Hillel is saying, well, technically this isn't a lie, so it's okay. So Beit Hillel is kind of like the wise guys that are sneaking around, going through the back alley, and Beit Shammai are just saying, that's it, there's no lies and there's no exceptions. That's a little bit, actually, I think, easier to understand. It's kind of like, once you start making exceptions, like we already saw, lying is such something that's so tadir for us, it just happens all the time, it's so easy to get into, that once you start making exceptions, then it's just going to snowball. It's kind of, I'm trying to make us a little bit more sympathetic to Beit Shammai that did not make themselves so sympathetic in the Gemara. Okay, and so again, this is, Beit Hillel would be, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, so it's true, and Beit Shammai would say, it's not true. Letter of the law, that it's not true. It's a lie, so no doing. Okay, and Rashi seems to, possibly take a similar approach, or maybe hint to it, or it could fit with this approach. He explains when you say chasuda, this is source 9, chutzal chesed moshach alav. So there's some sort of aura of chesed, of loving kindness around a bride when she gets married. So look, you're not saying, it sounds like you're saying she's pretty. But that's not necessarily what you're saying. Maybe you're saying that, she's so happy. There could be other meanings. So it seems like Rashi could fit in this idea of, you mean one thing and they understand another thing. They think you mean she's pretty, you mean, wow, she looks so happy, or she looks like she has this aura, she's glowing, Not glowing with beauty, she's just glowing. Okay, now we have the next approach, which... let's, again, just set up what's the base. Bless you. What's the base? Lying is only usser if it harms someone else. That's the base. They both agree. Now let's figure out what they disagree with. Okay. But we have a machloket whether this case specifically is going to cause harm. Okay, so you're only allowed to lie. You're only allowed... oh, whoa, I'm sorry. Getting freaked. Lying is only usser if you're going to harm someone else. So if you say, let's go back to the lasagna and meatballs, that didn't harm anyone. Did anyone get harmed by the fact they said I ate lasagna when I really ate meatballs? Yeah. So, yeah, you can lie. No, you didn't commit any avera. Nothing happened. Nothing went into the world. Okay? So that's kind of they both agree. Beit Shammai is on the same page. But they disagree about this case of ne'eva chasuda. So Beit Hillel thinks that you are not harming someone. Actually, they might say if you tell the truth, you might be harming someone. They might, kind of take the opposite route. But Beit Shammai actually think that you are causing harm by lying in this situation. And we kind of hinted at this already. What would that harm be? It would be that you're causing gnevas das. You made him think he has a beautiful wife and he doesn't. So let's see that. This is in the Sefer Ha'ira. Let's look at that. So let's look at the bold. Okay, so we have our general prohibition. So what is Midbar Sheker Tirchak prohibiting us against? Only things that are going to cause nezek, damage. So things that will harm. I don't think he means like physical, nezikin. I think he means also like emotional... things that could, harm someone in any way. Not just, you broke someone's window and you lied about it. Okay, and then he brings all sorts of cases. He goes back to that Gemara in Shavuot that we've already mentioned, Alam Adav, and he shows how all those cases are causing harm. That's why those cases were approved by Midrash Sheker Tircha, because they were all causing harm. So, again, everyone is kind of using this Gemara in Shavuot to sort of bolster their own opinion. Okay, Aval, if you look again, the next bolded later on in the paragraph, Aval Shekrosha Eino Bali De Ra'ah, Lo Izara Torah Lav. But a sheker that's, you know, doesn't cause any harm, this is kind of like the white lies piece that I sort of teased in the title. If it doesn't cause any harm, there's nothing wrong with it. There's no, you know, it even kind of sounds a little bit, we're going to kind of, some of them kind of bleed into each other, but you could also say, like, maybe the lie actually makes things better. You know, I told someone I liked their cake when they asked, and that actually made it better. It would have been worse to tell the truth. That's kind of, I think, the position that Beit Hillel put themselves in, is not just that this, what you're saying, that she's an Eva Chasuda, is not usher because it's not harming someone. They might even say further, if I tell the truth, that's where I'm causing harm. So they've kind of, you know, sort of switched around position. But where does Beit Shammai stand? Look at this last line, this last bold. La Torah Amra, Midvar Sheker Tircha, Ha'i Yeshbo Ra Labriot, Kedivrei Beit Shammai, Shanira Kegonev Dad Habal. So what's the issue here? He thinks that you're being Gnevastas, you've done Gnevastas, you've lied to this groom and made him think he has a beautiful wife. You've deceived him in that way. And apparently, if you thinking that you have a beautiful wife when you really don't objectively have a beautiful wife is damage, is harm. That's the assumption here. So Beit Shammai, what are we really trying to get out of this? We don't necessarily need to remember all of the ins and outs of the Ne'eva Chasuda, but let's remember, you know, take away if we're going to remember something, is that this position supposes that you can lie as long as it doesn't harm someone. So that's, you know, if you wanted to come out of here with the halacha supports me to lie when it doesn't harm anyone. So there you go. This is your position. Okay. I just want to, on this position, just take a little bit of like a, I don't know, shkafik. Maybe it veers into a little bit of mussar. Everything I say that's mussar is obviously always on myself. If you look at source 11 in the Rambam, he doesn't actually ever bring down a prohibition against a general prohibition against lying. So that's telling in and of itself. But he does in Hilchot Deot, which is all about, you know, your character traits, perfecting your character traits, he does mention something about lying. He says in the bolded, V'lo yeh echad bapev echad b'leiv, ilo tilcho kiboro v'enyan shebeleiv hu devar shebepet. So don't be two-faced. That's basically what he's saying. Don't be one thing on the outside and another thing on the inside. So I think this is just a good sort of check to this opinion that lying in general is permitted as long as it's not harmful. I think it's a good check because you could say that, but then we know, again, as we've already said, it sort of spirals. Once you start saying something is, you know, this lie is okay, it can sort of spiral, and not just that, you can start to become someone that's a little bit fake. You know, it kind of erodes a little bit. Each time you lie, it kind of erodes your sense of, oh, this was a lie, and it can, you know, kind of snowball, and you can actually start making lies that do harm people without even realizing it and sort of justifying it for yourself. So I think it's just an important check, is not to say, oh, you know, you have a free pass to lie as long as it doesn't harm someone, so every night lie about what you had for dinner, and every night lie about how long it took you to get to work, and every night lie about, you know, this or that. Because I think what the Rambam is trying to say is you become someone who's one thing on the outside and another thing on the inside, and that's bad for your character. So it's not to say, you know, it's not to say never lie, you know, this, to completely kind of fold over this opinion and close it. This opinion stands, it's legitimate, and, you know, I don't think there's something inherently wrong with it. It's going to definitely erode your character. I just think it's something to bring up so you don't walk from the shir saying, not that you think this, but that Mindy said you could just lie every day and nothing will happen to you, and it's great for your character. So I don't say that, but it is definitely an interesting and important opinion. Now we're going to go to the third opinion, which is that lying is usur, except for the purpose of darchei shalom. So you can, this is kind of the, sort of the backwards of what we said about harming, that Beit Hillel was like, oh, if you do tell the truth, that's going to be harming someone. So this is kind of that approach. You can only lie if it's going to keep the peace. So this is obviously more restricted than the second approach, because this is not, you can lie about what you ate for dinner. Because unless that's darchei shalom, because your husband or wife made something and you hated it, so you threw it out, and you know you ate something else, and that was darchei shalom. Unless that's the situation, if you're just lying stam, that's not permitted. It has to be for this express purpose. Every single lie has a thesis. Is this for darchei shalom or not? And if it's not, you can't do it.
So that's the third approach, and this is an approach expressed in the Ritva, which is source 12, but the words are not until the next page. Sorry for that layout. So if you see here, Pirish, this is that he's explaining the Gemara, Dechol Shehu Mipnei Darchei Shalom. So what was Beit Hillel's approach? Everything, you can lie in any time for Darchei Shalom, and clearly this is a case of Darchei Shalom. I mean, even that you know, kind of statement from Chazal that we quote at the end, the Gemara seems to support this opinion, because he said, oh, from here we learn that you always have to be, you know, get along with people. That seems like Darchei Shalom. That's, you know, we go like Beit Hillel because we always have to get along with people. So it seems like it does fit well with the words of the Gemara. So again, so this is, you know, Darchei Shalom. And now I want to look at Darchei Shalom and other exceptions, because it turns out, if you actually go into the in the Gemaras, there is more than one, you know, exception that can justify lying. Darchei Shalom was the exception that justified lying in our sugya, which is the main, you know, a very important sugya about lying. But there are other exceptions that come up. So the Darchei Shalom, just to quickly spell it out. In our Gemara, obviously, Darchei Shalom, preserving the peace, you know, you're at a wedding, you're not going to tell the bride that she's ugly. Beit Shammai, what's their opinion? No, you can never lie. Again, this is they take the absolutist approach. You can't even lie for Darchei Shalom. So that kind of goes back to what their approach was in the beginning. They're very absolutist. And Beit Hillel is of the opinion that you can lie for Darchei Shalom. So that's the two sides. And obviously, at a wedding, the Darchei Shalom comes in pretty clearly. Okay, so let's look at some of the other exceptions. So first we have, in source 13, Misachi Yevamot, we have some, it's actually fun, we're going to do some more Tanakh. Rabbi Eliyahu Mishum Rabbi Yezer Barabbi Shimon, Mutar Lo Adam Lashon Ot Bedvar HaShalom. Okay, so this is going to be our Darchei Shalom. Like we saw our Gemara, according to the Ritva, is about Darchei Shalom, and then this Gemara is going to be about Darchei Shalom, and then we're going to look at some other factors. So, interestingly, just to note, we use the word Lishonot. We didn't use Lishaker. So I think there's something about what the... I think it has to do, my personal reading, I'm sure there's plenty of very interesting readings on this, but I think it has something to do with like what your intention is. If once you're doing something for Darchei Shalom, it's not Sheker anymore. You know, you're changing it. It becomes a different thing. It's qualitatively a different act. Once it's for Darchei Shalom, it's no longer L'Shaker. Now it's become L'Shanot. Okay, so how do we know? First, how we know it's mutter, we're going to get this nice proof. Let me just summarize, actually, outside. It'll be a little bit faster. So we get three stories from the Tanakh. The first is Yosef and his brothers. So this is at the end, after Yaakov dies, the brothers start freaking out. You know, we did a pretty bad thing. It's not crazy. They did a pretty bad thing to their brother, and he's very powerful, and they're worried now that their father is dead, he's going to retaliate against us. Okay, makes sense. And they tell their brother, our father told us that you should treat us nicely when he's gone. Okay, we have no record in the Torah of that happening. So the working assumption of basically everyone is that this was a lie. Because it wasn't written, it didn't happen. It's interesting because that's not always the assumption of how we read the Torah, is that just because something wasn't written, it didn't happen. But for some reason here, we say, didn't happen. So, seems to be a lie. Now we have one step further. That case was mutar. Now we have Rabbi Natan takes it up a notch and he says, mitzvah. How do we know it's a mitzvah? Because when we have the story of Shmuel, when he anoints David, he tells Shaul that he's going to bring a korban in Beit Lechem. And he deliberately omits the fact that he's also going to anoint the next king. That's a pretty big omission. So that's how we know it's a mitzvah, because God told him to do it. God told him, just tell him you're going to bring a korban. So that... I want to go through all the lies for a second, but okay, that was clearly a lie by omission. And then we have Rabbi Yishmael, who says, Gadol HaShalom. Clearly, Gadol Mi Emet. So, look how great Shalom is, greater than truth. Sha'af HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shinabo, because even HaKadosh Baruch Hu changes the truth. So this is a classic, like, Shalom Bayis shir, I feel like, comes up. So God, when Sarah overheard that Avram was told, you're going to have a baby, Sarah's going to get pregnant, and she lied, and she said, I'm old, but she also definitely said, my husband is old, and, you know, she laughed about it, and when God speaks to Avraham, he does not mention the fact that his, you know, Avraham's wife kind of knocked him down and said, like, oh, he's so old. Yeah.
I understand it for God, but this is a dangerous path for humans. This is rationalization, and it's very dangerous because you can rationalize anything this way.
I totally agree. So I think the absolutist approach is very tempting because it makes things very clear. You cannot do this. Once you put, you know, power in the hands of humans, you know, I totally agree. There's something very tempting about, and even if you, you know, you can always rationalize and you can always also build without even realizing that you're rationalizing. The Dorothy Shone piece is specifically easy to rationalize because you see, you think you're doing it for good intention and it can end up sort of blowing out of control, or you could be biased about what the, if it was a good intention or not. I think I would say to that, one, okay, so you could be an absolutist. That's one way to take it, one way to cut it. But I also think there's something about, you know, being a religious person that has to do with, you know, God has given us this power and has given us this responsibility with great power and responsibility. You know, I think there's something about living in that nuance and that difficulty that's valuable. I think, like, I mean, classic example is, you know, being a modern Orthodox Jew. It would be a lot easier to turn your phone off, turn your computer off, turn your TV off, and totally, maybe TV was a bad example. I don't know how valuable TV is. Okay. But to turn off, you know, the outside world and, you know, to shut everything off, never read a single English, you know, piece of literature, never take a single college course. That would be a lot easier, you know, to remain faithful. But my personal approach, I assume the approach of people in the synagogue, because it's a modern Orthodox synagogue, is that that's not the most valuable way to be a religious person. So while I totally and completely am sympathetic to that concern, I think that's, you know, part and parcel of being a religious person. So I guess that would be not a response, but...
No, I agree. But you mentioned also that this might be considered Musar, and we always say that if we are repeating a trait, and in this case potentially a negative trait,
mm-hmm.
then that's also... You become, in a sense, defective just by repetition, and that's not necessarily something we want.
Right, I totally agree that you can become easily desensitized, and someone who started out really for the right intentions being, you know, I can lie for Darkly Shalom, can easily kind of fall into the trap of everything is Darkly Shalom, or, you know, I 100% agree. I think that this approach, which again, as we already said, is not the only approach, is really giving a lot of credit to human beings. I agree. And maybe too much credit, you might say. Okay. Just to analyze the different cases for a second, just quickly. First case with Yosef, this was the only active lie that we have. The other two, the Shmuel case and the Hashem speaking to Avram case, were actually lies by omission. So that's an interesting point. You know, what's the difference between active lies? That seems probably worse. But all of them, at the base level, seem to be mutter. The only one that was a mitzvah was the one that was actually explicitly commanded by God to Shmuel. That we were told was a mitzvah. The other two elements here, which actually might play into what you're saying about Darkei Shalom, is that what actually is Darkei Shalom? Like, how does Darkei Shalom shake out in each of these cases? In the first case, Darkei Shalom is not just brothers getting along, they're afraid for their lives. So Darkei Shalom here is actually self-preservation. I think the same is true about Shmuel. If he tells Shaul the truth, if he doesn't omit, you know, that he's going to anoint David, he's definitely going to die. Shaul has shown that he has murderous tendencies. And he's going to show that again and again in this Sefer. So I think both of these, you know, maybe this speaks a little bit to your concern, is that maybe it's a higher level than we think. It's not just like, oh, I don't want, you know, the lady in the book club to be mad at me that I didn't like her brownies. It's like, you know, and that might, you know, be a lower level that kind of permits us again and again to lie. It's like a really big thing. It's like lie if your life is in danger kind of lie. So that might be the situation. Although the last case goes against that flow, because the last case is not a life-threatening in any way. First of all, God is saying, yeah, that's a pretty big deal. And second of all, it's really just a lie, you know, Shalom bias. This is about Shalom bias, which, you know, maybe takes a higher priority than just generally getting along. So that's, I think, maybe speaks to your point a little bit. This next, source 14, it says in Masechet Tanot, that's wrong, I apologize, it's in Masechet Avot Rabbi Natan. We have this really interesting little piece about Aaron, who, if you might be familiar, is Rodei Shalom Ba'ohiv Shalom. So we would expect him to come up in a conversation then about Darkei Shalom, you know, lying for the sake of truth, and that's exactly what we have. We quote this pasuk. I'm from Malachi. Torah met haitabek biu va'ala lo nimsa b'sata v'shalom mishor halach iti v'rabim hishim evom. We're on line 2 of source 14. Okay, so we have this pasuk in Malachi, which the Avot Rabbi Natan decides is about Aaron, and we have, you know, Torah emet haitabefiu, but what we want to ask about is Rabim Hashim Avon. Apparently, he stopped a lot of people from sinning. So how did he do that? So I'm just going to summarize it, but it's, this story starts on 5 lines in the chain. So I'm just going to summarize it outside. Basically, we're told that that Aaron would see, okay, me and Shira are fighting, and Aaron would see me, and he'd say, and when we're both mad at each other, neither of us is giving. Aaron sees me, and he says, Shira is just crying. She cannot get over this. She's so upset. She can't believe she hurt you. Meanwhile, Shira is not, she's mad at me. She's not regretful, remorseful in any way. She's just mad at me. But Aaron is telling me Shira is so regretful. She feels so terrible, but she's too embarrassed to tell you. And then now I'm starting to calm down. And then he goes to Shira and says the same thing. Before, I was totally mad. I did not feel bad about this. But now he tells Shira the same exact thing. She feels terrible. Please forgive her. She can't get over this. And then we see each other and we give each other a nice kiss. That's the end of it. And we're so happy. So he totally lied to us. But he did it for Shalom, so that's the justification. What's interesting, actually, about this source is that the pasuk that we quoted is Torat Emet Haitabasiyu. So this is just pasuk little chab. Is either we're saying that we could be saying one of two things. Either we could be saying that Shalom is greater than truth. So Aaron is allowed to lie to both of us because the value of two friends getting along is greater than the value of us, being honest. Or we could say actually that at a certain point, the value of Shalom becomes truth. So that's why I think it's interesting about the fact it says Torat Emet Haitabasiyu. So the pasuk that we're using for Aaron is specifically Torat Emet. What was the Torah that was on his mouth was Emet, even though the story is explicitly telling us that he lied. So it's almost as if because the situation is Shalom, the truth becomes different. We have a different reality. The lie becomes the truth. So that's, I think, two kind of ways to understand that. Second is a little bit more meta. But either way, clearly we're seeing, different ways to understand what Darkei Shalom is. Is it just, people getting along in general? Is it Shalom bias? Is it saving your own life or someone else's life? That's our different ways to understand Darkei Shalom and different justifications, again, according to the Ritva, for lying. Okay, now we're going to get some new factors. So we're not going to go into the background because it's unnecessarily complicated, but basically, if you find a vessel in the shuk and it has no heker on it, the assumption is you do not have to, try to find the owner because we don't think that a new vessel with no heker on it, someone will really recognize it because it's brand new, so they won't recognize it. So we think, you're probably just going to get scammed. Someone's going to lie and pretend it's theirs. So there's no obligation for you to go, find its owner. Because we don't trust that someone could really claim it and recognize it. But we get an exception. If we have a Talmud Chacham who has certain characteristics, which we'll get into, he does this certain thing, then we would trust him to recognize the vessel. Because we'd believe him that he wouldn't lie. So what is that Talmud Chacham? It's someone who has only lied about three things. So the assumption, again, this Gemara is very much in touch with the way that humans work, is that, yeah, maybe you shouldn't lie, maybe it's not good for your personality, but the truth is people do lie. But a Talmud Chacham who only lies about these three things, that is a real trustworthy person. And even the situation where we generally don't trust people, we would trust him. Okay, so what are those three things? This is three lines from the bottom. De Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel Bahani Tzlat Milei Avdi Rabbanan De Mishanim B'Milu B'Mesachet B'Puria U'B'Shbiza. Okay, what are these three things? The first one, Mesachet, that, I'll just explain to you outside. Basically, that seems to be, this is all in the commentary on the Gemara, but just to, shorten things a little bit. Mesachet seems to be humility and modesty, and Mesachet is interpreted as meaning how many Mesachot have you learned? So they could lie and say, they learned all of Shas 20 times, but they'll lie and say, I just learned one Mesachet. So they're lying for humility. So if you're lying for your own humility, not for the humility of someone else, not to make someone else look bad, to make yourself, more humble and modest, that lie seems to be okay. So just to clear, spell this out explicitly, it seems to imply that these three lies are mutter. Even if everything else is aser, these three would be mutter because we're saying this kind of person is a trustworthy person. So it seems to imply that it's, these things are okay. Second is Puria. So that we have in 16:17 in Machloket, and finally a little Machloket between Rashi and Tosfot. Rashi says Puria means if someone asks you if you slept with your spouse last night, you can lie for sneeze reasons and say, yes, you could say no. Or whatever. You don't have to answer. So, interesting Rashi. Tosfot, even though, I didn't bring all the Rashi's and Tosfos to explain this, but I did bring these two because they're just kind of funny. Tosfos responds to Rashi and is like, "In Rigi Luchish the Luke of Harish Rashi." It doesn't make any sense. Who does Rashi know? I think that's kind of like Tosfos. Who asks people that? Pretty true. Who does that? Obviously, this is not the understanding. And then he explains that actually what it means is if someone is a Balkari, someone has a seminal emission, which is something that could be embarrassing, and so they couldn't go to the Beit Midrash because they have to, you know, go to the mikvah, or, you know, they can lie and they could say they were sick and not that they were Balkari, because that's embarrassing. So that seems to make a little bit more sense. You know, you can lie for, you know, to preserve yourself from humiliation. You know, extreme humiliation, let's say. And he also says you can lie, you know, if someone asks, is that your bed? And they see the seminal mishnah, you can say no, even if it is. Again, to preserve yourself from this extreme humiliation. So that's the difference between Rashi and Tosfos. So Rashi seems to be saying it's about modesty, you know, snias, and Tosfos seems to be saying it's more about, like, busha, about saving yourself from this humiliation. And then the last one, Ushpiza, it's kind of funny. Basically, Ushpiza is interpreted as, like, someone, you know, someone is such a good hostess that, you know, they can never say no to anyone. And you know, let's say Shira is the best hostess in the world. She never says no to anyone, and I'm good friends with Shira, and I know she'll never say no. And someone comes over, they just want to mooch off of Shira. And I know they're just going to mooch off of her until the end of time. They're never going to leave her house, and they're just going to cause her so much sorrow, and she can't say no because she's a nice person in the world. So I'm allowed to lie and say, oh, no, Shira is not taking any guests now. Even if you asked her, she would take you in. So that's what Ushpiza is understood as. It's like that would be like to prevent an extreme inconvenience for someone else, again, you know, for a good reason. So those all seem to be nice things. Not necessarily intuitive, but okay, once you hear them, they kind of make sense. Okay, now we have another, we're adding one more factor, which is financial loss. So this one's interesting. I think this one is perhaps the most dangerous when we get into, like, you know, the idea of rationalization. You could justify a lot of things for financial loss, and a lot of people are in jail for rationalizing why they lied about financial loss, like prevent financial loss. So this is easily, I think, the most difficult one to deal with. I don't really have an answer for you other than it seems to be that these gemaras that we're going to look at seem to indicate that it would be permissible to lie, although I will say once we look at it, the circumstances of their lives were definitely different circumstances than the lives that we live today. Okay, so let's look at the first one. This is Masechta Nedarim, source 18. Okay. Nodir Lahargin, Lachamrin, and Lachsin. So we have these three people that come to your door. A tax collector, a robber, and a murderer. What a nice group of people. It really shows them what they thought about tax collectors. Although I will say, they were oftentimes being taxed by people who were not of their own, you know, they did not have self-government. So I don't know if this essentially says the same about how we should feel about our tax collectors, because we are active citizens and free and equal citizens. So, whatever. But obviously, they had a different social reality. So their tax collectors are not very nice. They don't like them very much. And just to clarify, you know, from the get-go, these are people who are suspected of being a murderer, suspected of being a robber, suspected of being a tax collector. Now, if we had an actual murderer come to your door, obviously you're allowed to lie, because it should go without saying that pikuach nefesh, you know, is obviously docha of any prohibition against lying. So that's kind of like sort of the obvious. Maybe I should have said that at the start and I just forgot, but obviously if it's a situation of pikuach nefesh, you can lie. That kind of goes in a little bit to the Yosef and Shmuel thing that we said, like it seemed like self-preservation. So in that situation, obviously you're allowed to lie. But here we have a situation where it's more like maybe they will kill you, but they probably won't. And it's really about your financial loss. So what is the situation? Shehi truma, afo pi she'ena truma. So if they're coming to collect your taxes, or they're coming to take something from you, you can say that it's truma, even if it's not truma. So this is interesting. I don't know if this really applies to the tax collector, but when you think about the robber and the murderer, just think about a society where the robber and the murderer are either going to murder you for your wheat, or they're going to steal from you. But when they find out it's truma, then that's a line they won't cross. It's an interesting, it's like very much, you know, like that, what they tell you about, like, Chorban Bayit Sheni, that, like, you know, we just, like, lost the interpersonal kindness, but we were keeping all the mitzvot. You know, okay, relate that to modern society however you want. Okay. Shehin shel Beit HaMelech, afo pi she'ein shel Beit HaMelech. Okay, so this is less of a funny one, but, okay, you could say that it belongs to it's the property of the king when it's not, and then they won't take it from you. Beit Shammai Amrim, b'chol nodrin chutz meishvua. So this is interesting, because before we were saying maybe Beit Shammai takes this absolutist approach, this seems to indicate otherwise, because here Beit Shammai actually says, you're allowed to make a neder, you just can't make a shvua. Okay, like the difference between neder and shvua are like kind of technical, we don't want to really get into that, but let's just say shvua is more chamor. Okay, Beit Hillel Amrim af b'shvua, but Beit Hillel take it, as they did before, take it one step further. No, you can even make a shvua on this. You can even, like, swear and say that this is truma just to protect your property. Beit Shammai Omrim, lo yiftach, lo beneder, v'hil Omrim, av yiftach beneder. So this means, like, you can, Beit Shammai say, you can't start off with a neder. They kind of have to force you into the neder. Take a neder on this, or I won't believe you, then you can take the neder. But Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel are saying, you can just, they open the door, and you can just say, neder that this is truma. Like, you don't even have to wait for them to press you. So they're really lenient, actually, about this lie. Seem to be, feel really strongly about not paying this. Okay, now we see again another tax collector in Masechta Nedarim, verse 19. Amar Rabba, Shari li l'servim Rabbanan l'meimar, Avid adenura ana, lo yahivna achagra, mai tama, l'avruchei arye minei kamar. Okay, this is such a fascinating little piece here. Rabba says, a servim Rabbanan, that means a Talmud Chacham, like a young Talmud scholar, is basically what it means. Okay, he can say when someone comes to collect taxes, I am a servant of fire. So I'm basically, it means I'm a worshiper of Avodah Zarah. It's fascinating. In order to not have to pay this head tax, which was a tax you had to pay unless you were in the priestly class. If you're a priest, then you don't have to pay it if you're a secular priest. So you can lie and say you are a secular priest. A Talmud Chacham can lie and say he's a secular priest, so he doesn't have to pay this head tax. And the Gemara answers, Avruchei Arimine. Why can he do this? Because he's chasing away the lion. So how do we understand that? So the Chidushei Rashba understands, you know, there's two ways to understand this. Either we say that it's, you can say it because it's obviously not true. That's his first response. Like, everyone around this guy knows he's not a worshiper of Ozar. We all know he's a Talmud Chacham. Clearly he's saying this to get out of paying, and so it's not considered a Chilul Hashem. That's his first answer. And then he also says, that seems to be the answer that he goes with, and he says in the bold, B'yesh mi shapire sh'omer avda denura mikevan libo l'shamayim dichtiv eish achlulahu. V'harishon yirat yikar. Okay, so he gives this answer, which ties back to what we've said already, but he doesn't hold by it, but it's just interesting to note. Avda denura could be a way of saying, I'm a worshiper of God, but they don't realize that you're saying that, because we understand, you know, God is an Esha Chula, he's this all-consuming fire, so when you say Avda denura, it has two meanings. So we go back to this two-meaning shtick. Okay, I said your wife was beautiful, obviously what I meant, you know, not obviously, it seems apparent to you, the groom, that what I meant was, I think she's beautiful. But what I mean in my mind is that you think she's beautiful because, objectively, I think she's kind of ugly. We have the same situation here. I know when I'm saying Avda Denura, you think I'm a priest, tax collector. But when I'm saying it, I'm thinking I'm an Eved of Hashem. So we have this double meaning. So the Rashba does not hold by this. He thinks it's like kind of, I think he just mentioned it just, you know, because it's cute, honestly. But he doesn't think it's right. But it, again, goes back to that double meaning. If it has a double meaning, then you can say it. But we see him, just to summarize, what are our, you know, extenuating circumstances where you could lie, according to this approach of Darchei Shalom. And, you know, I kind of think it's like Darchei Shalom and colliaries. I never pronounced that word right. Okay, so, again, base, lying is usher, unless Darchei Shalom, or what are the other cases? We had the different ways to understand Darchei Shalom, either it's, you know, self-preservation, we had understanding that it's Shalom bias between a husband and a wife, we have understanding between friends, so just in general people getting along, and then we have the Puria, so modesty, we have the, you know, the Busha, modesty or Busha, and then we have the Masechet, so humility and extreme humiliation, and then we also have financial loss. I will say, you know, just to understand the financial loss a little bit, because it is difficult to understand, like, why should this be okay? It seems to justify a lot of things today that we would think are unjust, so I think it has to do with the fact that they're living in a society that is maybe unjustly collecting from them. So it's kind of like that, it still feels kind of sketchy, but it's like maybe the ends justify the means. They're being unfairly burdened with this tax, and they're not, it's not like they're getting rights or anything. I mean, they didn't really have that kind of system, but it's not like they're getting rights. So don't apply this today and say, oh, I can lie about my taxes because it causes a financial loss.
Job in certain communities of making sure they understand this.
Yes, clearly. Okay. Clearly. I mean, I hope that no one is using these gemaras to prove why they cannot pay taxes. I hope that they think it's bad, but they just do it anyway. I would hope. But let's say, okay, even if they don't, I think it would be a stretch to say that this would justify like a financial loss. Also, that causes harm to others. Okay. So now let's go back to Yaakov and kind of, you know, close the book a little bit. So I brought this chasam sofer, which does, you know, kind of go back to the first approach that we had, which is you know, lying is usher, but then Beit Hillel says it's okay if it has two meanings, so it could be true. So that's really where the Chasam Sofer is coming from, because he's saying, he understands Beit Hillel saying, it's not really sheker because, you know, it could be true because, first of all, you know, she's chasuda because she's snias, al b'nai Yisrael are snias, so it really is true, and also she's ne'eh because, you know, b'nai Yisrael have a chaskas kashrut, which would make them ne'eh, chas kashrut meaning like they're presumed to be modest, sexually modest, so, you know, basically he's saying it has a double meaning, so ne'eh v'chasuda doesn't have to mean beautiful, so you can say it. So he's in that line, but I want to talk about it in relation to Yaakov because of how he ends it off. Basically, let's go, let me just look where to start here. Okay. So Imkain, let's go to Imkan Logneva Stas, below Devar Shakar, Kiman Shekinagu, Kedamarinan. Okay. So basically he says, you know, it's not a situation of, according to Beis Hillel, it's not a situation of Gneivas Das, it's not a situation of Sheker, because it could have this double meaning, it's A-okay. But then he does kind of temper this approach. Im yish sham chaver ir mutar, ein sham, umizah hotzi sham betorachata perak aleph, mutar lo mar lechaviro, this is the last, second to last line of source 21, the Chasam Sofer. Okay, so he brings this case. Basically, this is really relatable. You know, you have like all these invites, you're supposed to invite people back for Shabbos lunch, you know, they invite you, you gotta invite them. Okay, so think about someone, you know, you have to invite, you don't really want to invite them. And you hear them telling someone else, oh, I'm not going to be here that week. So you think, okay, great, now I get the points for inviting them, but they can't show up. So that's the opposite of a case that would be permitted, which is, you can, even if you know that, let's say, you know, I really want to have Shira over, but I know she's going to say no, either because she's really busy or because she just, you know, is too nice to, you know, cause me a burden, but I want to give her that kavod of knowing that I want to have her. I sincerely want to have her, and I want to give her that kavod, despite the fact that I know she's going to say no. In that situation, I'm allowed to say yes. If it was a situation where, I want Shira to think that I want to have her over when I really don't, so I want to get the points for inviting her, chas v'shalom, I want to get the points for inviting her, even though I don't actually have to deal with her, that's no, because that's not for the kavod of the other person. So he seems to be indicating a certain principle here, which is the issue of, you know, gneivas das has to do with kavod. You can do something which, you know, it might feel like gneivas das because I know that they can't come, so maybe I'm getting points, but as long as it's for that person's kavod, as long as you're thinking, what is really going to make that person happy? Shira's going to be happy to know that I invited her, and it's not because I want to get the points for myself that she thinks that I, you know, whatever, it's because I want to make her feel special. Then you can do it. Then it's not Gneivas Das. Okay. V'hachanami dikvatei ayin olifaneinu mishum mashakatuv. Okay, so yeah, he basically just says, like, this is, you know, what we learned. Okay, and I think this is important for the Yaakov case and important also for the Lion case. It goes back, I think it actually fits into two of the lenses that we looked at. The first, again, was, you know, things going two ways. As long as you can, you know, be clever enough to get something that is technically true, you can say it. But he also seems to going a little bit into the harming. You know, lying is usur if it's harming someone. So that kind of, I think, goes into here a little bit is, you know, if it's for someone's kavod, you can do it. You can invite them even though you know they can't come. But if it's, you know, just for your own, I'm going to look like this amazing friend who has this person even though I know they're not gonna come. So that would actually be harm. So it seems to indicate that would be Gneivas Das. That would be a form of lying. Okay. So I wanna apply this to Yaakov because do you think Yaakov, when he was lying, even if we go with the Rashi piece for, oh, technically what he was saying, you know, it had this double meaning, which is, you know, what's great about the Chasam Sofer is kind of picks out both pieces. Because the Yaakov thing, according to Rashi, it did have this double meaning. Technically, it was true, but why does it not work out anyway? Because it wasn't really for the was it really for the kavod of Yitzchak? Maybe the commentators on the side that Yaakov is, you know, great and he didn't do anything wrong, maybe they would say it really is for the kavod of Yitzchak. He was doing it because he knew it was the right thing for the line of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Maybe, okay, I don't know. Maybe it was. But it kind of seems like it really wasn't for Yitzchak. Couldn't there have been a better way to do it if it really was for Yitzchak? That maybe he should have had a conversation with him, you know, to just go over his own father's head and deceive him in this way. It doesn't really seem like it was for Yitzchak's kavod. So I think that kind of, you know, just to sort of close the book on the Yaakov thing that we opened up in the beginning, it seems like even if we could say like Rashi, oh, it has this, you know, double meaning. Why was Rashi saying that? Because maybe then if it's technically true, then it's, oh, should we open this up? That was a knock. Okay, maybe then, you know, Yaakov was off the hook because it's technically true. But no, because even so, according to the Chasam Sofer, it wasn't for the kavod of Yitzhak, the person he was lying to. It was still a lie. And I brought these last few psukim just, again, I guess I'm very biased in this approach, but I do think that the Torah is kind of indicating to us that even if it wasn't technically a lie, there was something a little bit off about what Yaakov did. And if we're going to go back to the Masor, it kind of, you know, we should check ourselves when we're deciding, you know, is this a lie that's permitted or not? You know, it doesn't feel a little bit sketchy, you know. We could say Rashi's approach from here until tomorrow that technically it was true, but it doesn't feel right. If you read the psukim, it doesn't feel right. So I just brought these two psukim, but there's so much on this. But just these two, so when Esav comes, you know, he cries to his father. They kind of like a little like sliding door. Like one goes in, the other comes out. Esav comes in, and he starts crying that his brother took his bracha. And Yitzchak says to him, "Vayomer ba achicha b'mirma." Like Yitzchak just says it outright. Like your brother, mirma means trickery. Your brother has come in trickery. It's like the psukim are not dicing words, so why should we kind of, you know? And then this last piece is just again the just another example, but really there are a lot of how, you know, the Torah is trying to tell us maybe technically this was okay according to Rashi, but it really there was something not right about this when you know we have this whole story of Rachel and Leah, how they get switched. So when Yaakov confronts his father-in-law, what the heck have you done to me? So Vayomer Lavan lo yasekein b'mikomenu lateta sira lefnei b'chira. This is clearly, you know, a dig. I know what you did, and we don't do that here. And I know what you did, and it was wrong. I think, like, there's kind of this, yeah, it's coming from Lavan, who's not the greatest guy in the world, but I think it's also coming, sort of the narrator is kind of pushing through here and telling us there was something wrong about that. So that's, you know, when it comes to this prohibition of lying, even if we hold the most lenient opinion, which, I don't know, I guess darkly, I think probably the most lenient is that lying is mutter, unless you're harming someone. That's probably the most expansive. Even in that approach, we should always, like, you know, the Rambam mentioned, you know, your inside should be like your outside. You should really always be checking yourself. Like, was it really okay? You know, because sometimes, you know, we all have this internal sense. Is it okay or is it not okay? Does it feel right? Does it not feel right? And we should be in touch with that, even though, again, as you've already pointed out, it does require quite a lot of responsibility on our part, and it really entrusts a lot in mankind, which I think is something great and terrifying about being a religious person. And we should all feel empowered to go make those decisions for ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you.